Yo, it's JD to the C. Didn't work really, did it? Ah well, it's there now. Can't take that back. That's like undies at Primark, that. Non-returnable. A stain upon the world. Also like Primark. Here we are, episode 4, numero quattro, let's be having ya. You know the drill by now. I'm Aidan, and this is John Doe & Co, Tales of True Crime. If you don't know the drill, swan on down to your nearest Screwfix. Nah. Bloody hell, this episode's going to get butchered in editing. In all seriousness, please do go and have a listen to the first 3 episodes, tell your mates, share the love, and join me, friends, for episode 4, The Fickle Forest Fenn and His Fiendish Fortune. A-level English, that title. Onomatopoeia. Joking, obviously. I know a soliloquy when I write one. I'm pretty buzzing to be doing this episode. I mean, I'm buzzing to do all of them, but sometimes when they're about murder or horrible stuff, it's a little harder to be pumped all the time. Today, we're going to be looking at a real-life, sure-as-sharrow and good-as-Goonies treasure hunt. So, let's begin by talking about the titular Forest Fenn. He was born on 22nd of August 1930 to Lily Simpson Fenn and William Marvin Fenn. His grandmother, Ary Beatrice Simpson, grew up in the late 1800s when Comanche Indians were still knocking about, free from the genocidal reach of the white man. Sorry, not sorry. She often regaled Forrest with tales of the time, of cowboys and Indians and adventure on the plains. Forrest himself grew up in Temple, Texas, and was the middle child with an older brother, Skippy, which, like, no judging, but blimey, maybe reserve that moniker for a dog, eh? What's the pooch called? Aberforth. Kid called Fluffy and a dog named Zachariah. Maybe just me, but anyways. Skippy was born in 1928, and his younger sister June was born in 1932. He attended Lanier School, where his own da was principal. Papa principal. I actually managed to find yearbooks from the school in 1936, which was super interesting. You can find them online. It made me laugh though, because everyone has like the same 2 haircuts, and it's like in a game like GTA or something when you haven't unlocked the bomb dudes yet and you have to settle for the perm. I'm sure in 1936 they look fresh. Forrest fondly recalled his summers in Yellowstone National Park. He and his family, Skippy probably in the boot, used to vacation there a fair amount, driving down in their 1936 Chevy. The journey from Temple to Yellowstone was 1,600 miles and would take roughly 45 hours, as they would only travel 35 miles an hour. Yeah, sod that. I did a megabus from Southampton to Manchester which took 6 hours, and I was tempted to just escape through the septic tank and become a wild man in Stoke-on-Trent. Forrest loved to fly fish and explore the mountains and took up summer jobs delivering papers and washing dishes at local cafes. Quite an idyllic idea of childhood summer. Hope you're all having a hot Forrest summer. Forrest also tried with his brothers Donnie and Skippy to become self-professed buffalo cowboys. They tied a buffalo to the front bumper of the Skippy's car, with disastrous consequences. I know it was bloody ages ago, but surely that was always a bad idea. It's like a vaudeville jackass. Greetings and welcome to Twatbottom. Forrest and Donnie also went looking for Lewis and Clark, who were these two blokes back in the 1800s who were part of an expedition to explore and catalogue the recently discovered and unknown regions of the west of the USA. They searched around the Gallatin National Forest along the Madison River near Hebgen Dam in West Yellowstone. Forrest used to eagerly share how he keyed into his inner desperate Dan and found their way back to civilization by triangulating a southbound route and following the river downhill. Mental, to be fair. I get lost in Selfridges. Have to triangulate my way through the kitchenware next time. Follow the 200 quid potpourri pong downstream. They also tried to eat a porcupine on the way, along with baby Ruths. Hopefully not on that order, really. Went for the turbo hedgehog before the chockey was in the mood. Forrest attended middle school at Central Junior High. During these years, he grew in his appreciation for adventure and developed a knack for navigating student-teacher conflicts. A teacher named Miss Ford is often featured as the antagonist in Forrest's stories about his school life, but is also reported to secretly fancied her. Classic that, really. The conflict Forrest felt about wanting to do well at school and go off on worldwide adventures permeated his school life, and he found his mind wandering when in class, or when he was meant to be studying. This yearning for legendary quests would follow him throughout his life. He then attended high school at Temple High High School, where he met school sweetheart and future wife Peggy Jean Proctor. At 19 years old, Forrest attended Texas A&M Uni for 4 days until the registrar caught wind that he hadn't officially enrolled. 4 days at uni these days, probably a few hundred quid in tuition, mad lad. He then enrolled for real into the United States Air Force and was sent to school in Mississippi to study radar mechanics and was later accepted into pilot training. Forrest and Peggy dated throughout this time and married in December 1953 when Forrest finished flying school and Peggy finished her degree. The job took Forrest all over the world and his thirst for adventure was somewhat satiated. He was stationed in the States, Europe and Asia during his career. Obviously there's loads of things you need to sacrifice for a job like that, but man, the most exotic I have gotten for one of my jobs was going to a warehouse in Slough to catalogue props. Lovely. Thanks for asking. He flew many jets during his time in the force, including Lockheeds and Sabres, serious aircraft. He also went through helicopter school and was a general's aide and, during the Cold War, he flew an F-100 during nuclear alert missions in Germany. What a nuclear alert mission is, I'm not entirely sure, but it sounds like it could be pretty bloody nerve-wracking. Shortly after this, the Vietnam War broke out and Forrest found himself conducting airspace missions, including combat. He flew 328 missions, including at Ho Chi Minh, in 365 days. No days off when there's a war going on. He was shot down twice, including in his penultimate mission. He had to eject, survive, and eventually extract from the depths of the jungle. Fun fact, he was the 1,500th airman rescued during the war. When he wasn't doing absolutely mad, scary, shooty flying things, he travelled to the likes of Libya and the Sahara, collecting trinkets and mementos along the way. He recalled a particularly poignant memory of finding the metal grave marker of a French soldier from the French Indochina War of 1947. He found it by a waterfall in the long grass engulfed in mist in 1968 and claimed the experience stayed with him for the rest of his life. The bloke is just one of those people with endless experiences and stories. Like, a movie could be made for every week of the dude's life at this point. The events of the war had a monumental effect on Forrest, much like it did with many people who experienced it. He was awarded a Silver Star, 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses, a Bronze Star, 16 Air Medals, a Purple Heart, and the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, unofficially, for his service in Vietnam. I got a 15 quid Love to Shop voucher from work the other day. Got lit in Argos. Forrest Fenn decided he wanted to get into the art world once he retired from the Air Force. He wanted something new, a bit more chill, and potentially not to risk his life every day, which is, you know, fair play. He already harboured a great interest in collecting artefacts and travelling, but he wanted to combine this with an income to support his family. 2 young daughters named Zoe and Kelly. He started out casting bronze sculptures and trading them for Indian artefacts and other interesting items, such as rugs or paintings. Pretty soon, he amassed a collection of arrowheads, pottery, and a veritable smorgasbord of items from ancient civilizations. Better than your standard car boot, basically. This all led to the creation of Fenn Galleries, which would become famous at its location in Santa Fe, New Mexico. This gallery would become a nice little day out for the mega-rich and famous. Forrest sold paintings and artefacts to the likes of Steve Martin, Jackie Kennedy, Cher, and Steven Spielberg. Won't catch those lot down the range. Forrest became renowned for keeping good company and selling amazing art. He was probably the closest you can get to a real-life Indiana Jones. His collection included a mummified falcon from King Tutankhamun's tomb and Sitting Bull's peace pipe, itself worth around $1.1 million. A bloody good day at Antiques Roadshow. My nan would be absolutely buzzing. The museum was running for 16 years and reportedly made over $6 million a year. Not too shabby. Sadly, in 1988, Forrest had a really nasty turn of fortune. He was diagnosed with a lymphoma. This was after his father had passed away of cancer. The prognosis was not great and he was potentially only to have a few months left. This led to Forrest ruminating on the idea of legacy and how to be remembered beyond death. Now, the good news was that Forrest beat cancer. The whole ordeal acted as the impetus for the treasure hunt that Forrest would devise. He wanted to be remembered hundreds, potentially even thousands of years after he was born. Forrest began the process of selling his gallery and writing a book that would form the crux of his, and indeed thousands of others, next adventure. The book was called The Thrill of the Chase. The Thrill of the Chase was almost like an autobiography, full of short stories based on Forrest's youth and important memories. The book was self-published through his publishing company, One Horse Land and Cattle Co. Within its pages, he also detailed a pirate-baiting collection of treasure garnered over the years, including gold, jewels, and precious relics. Realising his ambition of leaving a lasting legacy, he hid this treasure and encouraged many a wannabe Indiana Jones to seek it out. He also hid the fortune as a way of getting people to see the great outdoors and the land he loves so much, as well as providing a well-needed boost during the financial recession. In the interest of providing a more detailed manifesto of the contents of the chest, the roll call is as follows. Ancient figurines, a 17th century Spanish ring, American Eagle gold coins, gold dust, gold nuggets, a gold disc, a 2,000-year-old fetish necklace, and a copy of 1999's Steptacular album by Steps. I was fibbing about one of those items. I will let you decide which one. The chest itself was also 12th century bronze and was roughly the size of a Happy Meal box and contained the 42 pounds of treasure. That's weight, not value, to point out the obvious. Within the chest was also a turquoise bead bracelet, which Forrest requested be returned to him. This was viewed by hunters as a symbolic completion of the quest and official recognition of the treasure's new owner. Between 2009 and 2010, Forrest trekked into the Rocky Mountains and hid the chest somewhere around Santa Fe, Yellowstone National Park. It was in 2010 that The Thrill of the Chase was published. In the back of the book was a poem which contained 9 clues to the whereabouts of the treasure. Clues that, when solved, would lead to the exact location. I did try to get a hold of this book to have a read myself, but the cost was so ridiculous I'd have had to find the treasure first to make the investment. Get on the Patreon, support the show, and maybe I'll be able to splash out on the more expensive text for some top-tier research. Shameless bit of promotion there, but gotta be done. Lucky for you, the poem has long been researched and dissected, so it is out in the public forum. Even luckier for you, I'm going to do a dramatic reading of it for you now. I did actually do GCSE drama, and have starred in many student films, so I really don't want to intimidate any budding Daniel Day-Lewis's, or indeed the real one. I know he's a big fan of the show. Alright, Danny? But stay with me and enjoy the poem. As I have gone alone in there, and with my treasures bold, I can keep my secret where, and hint of riches new and old. Begin it where warm waters halt, and take it in the canyon down. Not far, but too far to walk, put in below, the home of Brown. From there, it's no place for the meek. The end is drawing ever nigh. There'll be no paddle up your creek, just heavy loads and water high. If you've been wise and found the blaze, look quickly down, your quest to cease. But tarry scant with marvel gaze, just take the chest and go in peace. So why is it that I must go and leave my trove for all to seek? The answer I already know, I've done it tired, and now I'm weak. So hear me all and listen good, your effort will be worth the cold. If you are brave and in the wood, I give you title to the gold. Good, innit? So, Forrest was always very adamant that the right solves would get you to the right location. As the poem is so interpretive, however, hundreds of locations and theories spawn from every single line. The line in particular that generated a lot of speculation was the home of Brown. There's spots in the area which have Brown in the name, waterways with brown trout, forests with brown bears, a hut which was the home of a ranger with the surname Brown, bloody brown scenery. It's a lot to consider. Finding a 10x10x6 little box within thousands of square miles is pretty nuts. For around 10 years, nobody could find the treasure, though many tried. Reportedly, 65,000 gave it a go. For a while, the community got stuck with 4 of the 9 clues confirmed to be solved. It was even stated that people had got within 250 feet of the treasure. These factors helped generate a frenzy around the quest. People devoted years to finding it. The story appeared on the news. Social media groups numbering in the thousands spent countless sleepless nights poring over the clues and sharing breakthroughs. The subreddit had 1,600 regular contributors. Hunters all over the world, including Scotland and Iceland, made the trip during summers to search. Somewhat heartwarmingly, the search inspired this sense of community and camaraderie amongst the hunters, with people helping and guiding each other, like a thousand-strong version of the Gooners. Of course, this had a limit. People didn't want to fully show their hands and their potential souls for fear of someone getting to the treasure first. Amateur cartographers narrowed down the search to four possible states: Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. Using one of the clues, "The treasure is wet," they narrowed it down further to just Wyoming, which has many waterways. Sounds great, right? Only one state? Easy. The search area was narrowed from 27 million acres to 591,000 acres, roughly the size of the Sports Direct in Stratford. So yeah, still bloody massive, but a 98% reduction. Fenn commented on recalling scent of pine and pinion nuts, which gave further confidence to Wyoming being the place. The area is very hazardous for the ill-prepared. Bears are common in the area, and inclement weather and challenging geography have claimed the lives of some searchers. Five people died whilst hunting the Fortune. This actually led to the chief of New Mexico police, Pete Casitas, to plead with Forrest to end the hunt. He personally laid the endangerment of life at Forrest Fenn's feet. Bloody hell, the alliterative opportunities this guy affords. He's like a Marvel Comics character. Randy Billieu went missing in January 2016 and was unfortunately found dead in July of that year. His body was found by some workers in Rio Grande, and an autopsy was inconclusive. With that length of time and exposure to the elements, certain signs could have been clouded. Billieu's ex-wife publicly stated her opinion that the treasure was actually a hoax. Jeff Murphy was a 53-year-old man who was found dead on June 9th, 2017, after falling 500 feet down a steep slope in Yellowstone. Initially, no details were provided by the investigators, but a plea under the Freedom of Information Act led to the discovery that his wife reported he was looking for the treasure in the initial missing persons file. Just days later, Pastor Paris Wallace of Colorado failed to show up for a family gathering on June 14th, 2017, after he told them he was looking for the treasure. His car was found parked near the Taos Junction Bridge, and his body was found around 5 miles away downstream of the Rio Grande. Eric Ashby, 31, was found dead in the Arkansas River on July 28, 2017. His friends and family said he moved to Colorado the previous year in order to be in a better spot to search for the treasure. He was last seen rafting on the river around 15 miles upstream from where his body was found. His raft overturned and sadly, he was unable to escape. More recently, Michael Wayne Sexton was found dead by rescuers alongside 65-year-old male companion Steve Inlow, who thankfully recovered in hospital. Authorities were alerted by the party that rented them snowmobiles. They were found 5 miles from a site they were rescued from just a month earlier, near the Dinosaur National Monument of the Utah-Colorado border. So sad that these people just lost their lives for the search, which ultimately was meant to inspire excitement and lust for life. Never underestimate the wilderness, friends. Along with these tragic circumstances, there were also numerous controversies regarding searchers getting into legal hot water. An unidentified man was arrested in New Mexico in 2013 for damaging a cultural artifact when he dug beneath an iron cross near the Pecos River. In 2014, couple Daryl Seller and Christy Strawn were apprehended by park rangers in Yellowstone with a metal detector after they were caught camping without a permit and starting a small fire. Scott Conway was cited by New Mexico state officers after he dug a rather large hole near Lake Heron. What a time to be working as an official in New Mexico. Scott's back and he's dug a blooming great ditch near the lake. A Pennsylvania man, Robert Miller, was arrested in 2018 when he broke into Fenn's property and attempted to steal a Spanish chest, which he thought was the treasure. He was apprehended and held at gunpoint until law enforcement arrived. In 2019, David Hansen started a lawsuit against Fenn, claiming he deceived searchers and has made fraudulent statements. The case was thrown out. In January 2020, David Christensen had to be rescued by Yellowstone Park rangers after attempting to rappel 850 feet into the Grand Canyon from a rope tied to a railing. He had to spend a week in jail and pay rescue costs of over $4,000. He was banned from the park for 5 years. Maybe just go to Butlins next time, pal. Bingo night on Tuesday. Might not win millions in treasure, but a bottle of cheap Carver, 50 quid, and the look on Denise's face that you've done her in on the lines is quite frankly priceless. This whole debacle was in spite of the fact that Fenn himself stated that no climbing was needed and you could make it on foot. Bear in mind the bloke was 80-something when he hid the treasure, so I find it dubious that he swung off the canyon and popped it in a cave hundreds of feet in the air. That would make it impossible to find. But found it was. Segway, mate. Master level. On June 6th, 2020, Forrest posted on blog Thrill of the Chase that the treasure had been found. He said, "It was under a canopy of stars in the lush, forested vegetation of the Rocky Mountains and had not moved from the spot where I hid it more than 10 years ago. I do not know the person who found it, but the poem in my book led him to the precise spot. I congratulate the thousands of people who participated in the search and hope they will continue to be drawn by the promise of other discoverers. So, the search is over." Fenn went on to explain in an email that the treasure was found by a man from the eastern US and they had sent him a photograph for proof. Initially, the identity of the finder and the location were not disclosed. On June 16th, Fenn released photos of himself examining the chest and the contents within, as well as another picture of the chest where it lay. On July 22nd, the finder authorised Fenn to reveal that the haul was found in Wyoming, going some way to act as closure for the thousands of searchers. In December 2020, Jack Stuff revealed himself as the finder. Hope I'm pronouncing his name right. Jack Stuff? Stuff? Stuff. A medical student from Michigan, he initially didn't want to reveal himself for safety concerns, but an upcoming lawsuit threatened to reveal his identity anyways, so he conducted an interview where he outed himself. Well done, Jackie. Jack also reasoned that coming forward would aid people looking for answers and give the land of the search area some much-needed quiet and tranquility. People could go there just to enjoy its beauty rather than for the chance of making some cash. Jack was always a fan of mysteries and the unknown, a big fan of the likes of David Blaine, and became pretty obsessed with the treasure. He remarked that solving the poem relied a lot on the correct interpretation of the clues, more so than figuring out coordinates and the like. He was worried that he would become hated for almost ruining the fun and ending the quest. Completely understandable, but he really does seem from his words like a genuine bloke. Of course, this wasn't enough for some people. A lawyer who initiated a lawsuit claimed Jack stole HerSolve by hacking texts and emails. All this despite the fact that HerSolve led her to New Mexico, the completely wrong state. People also speculated this was all a hoax and the treasure may still be out there. Rumours sprouted that Forrest may have made the whole treasure up or faked the solve to prolong his legacy and launch him into legend. The salt is real, folks. A slight aside, I hope Jack has his tax sorted out and stuff. I found a website which is super interesting, fennstreasure.com, if you're interested, that is basically a big instruction manual for if you find the treasure, and it details everything from like sneaking it back to your car and avoiding being followed, through to the tax implications of finding it. One thing they don't show in the films. Indy finds the Ark and immediately flies to HMRC to fill out a P4765 declaring a treasure. So yeah, it's all very detailed, which you can go check out, but some major takeaways is that it would apparently be considered gross income, and if the treasure was valued at $1 million, you'd have to pay over $300,000 in taxes. Yeah, nah, just flog it on eBay, mate. If you can sell a chicken nugget shaped like a video game avatar for $10,000, I'm sure actual gold might get you a few bids. On September 27th, 2020, Forrest Fenn passed away at the age of 90. I appreciate he wanted this treasure to be hidden for the ages, but in a way, it brings a nice sense of catharsis that he saw it found. I personally really love the whole story, really. It brings a sense of magic to real life, and I love eccentric Willy Wonka-type characters. There's always more adventure to be had. And no, Jack is not revealing the location of where the treasure was found. that will remain a place of peace. Who knows, maybe you've walked right by it, or sat down beneath the pines and just enjoyed the view. That about brings us to a close here, friends. Thanks for listening. Remember to rate, review, subscribe, tell your mates, the usual. My Instagram and Twitter are at JohnDoeAndCoPod, if you'd like to have a look at the socials. If you want to support me, I would love that, and it would be super kind. Head on over to Patreon at patreon.com/JohnDoeAndCoPod and donate. The tiers start from as low as a cup of coffee a month, and there's plenty of bonuses to take advantage of. The more I get donation-wise, the better they'll become as well, so get on it. As always, you get a cheeky shout-out. It would mean a lot to me, and thank you so much once again. Feel free to DM me any suggestions for future episodes, as always. Next episode, we're diving headfirst back into the morbid and covering another true crime case, one that is really quite shocking, and I haven't seen covered all that much, the murder of Don Hardin, Hands of Horror. It should be super interesting, and I really hope to see you there. Thanks for being such good company, and peace out.